You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. The Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation is currently accepting applications for Northern New Mexico Tribal Business Scholarships. These awards are for Native American students attending four-year undergraduate programs in business-related fields in or out of New Mexico. The application deadline is June 15th. For more information, visit lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. That's lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. Or call 505-753-8890, extension 115. I'm very happy now to welcome Doug Lynam. He's author of the new book, From Monk to Money Manager. Welcome.
Thank you.
So this is not the kind of book I usually do here on the Radio Cafe that has to do with sort of business and self-help and things like that. But because it's such a thoughtful book and you have such an interesting background, I thought it might be just a nice conversation to have about money, which is something that most people or many people are kind of freaked out about. You, as a teenager, became interested in kind of living a life of service and selflessness, and you went through quite a journey in this pursuit. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, I grew up in a wealthy family where money was pretty abundant, but it was weaponized. And so it was the tool that my parents used to manipulate and control each other and their children. And it got, you know, even, you know, abusive at times, to put it mildly. And so I really, you know, rebelled and wanted to take the road less traveled. And so I tried to explore a lot of different options. And first it was kind of joining the hippie lifestyle and grew my hair out and wore ratty clothes and did that a whole bit. And then I got a little disillusioned with that. I appreciated the values, but I didn't really see, you know, the people. I was a teenager, for one thing. There was a sort of one-world ethic, which I really admired in sort of the hippie movement, but it didn't seem to translate into any action, right? It didn't seem to translate into real service of others.
Aren't you a little young to have gone through the hippie movement? I mean, that was the 60s.
Right. Wannabe hippie, I should say. Right?
Right.
You know, like you see, you know, I had the garb. I had all the accoutrements, but I didn't really, missed it by a couple decades in terms of the actual, you know, the cultural revolution that it inspired. And so, you know, I was into Dylan and all that good stuff. And that was great for a while, but it didn't really have enough substance to it, I would say, intellectually, philosophically, and sort of started questioning different values. And then I came out here to Santa Fe, to St. John's College, which I fell in love with. And that was a very heady life, so the life of the mind. And then I started doing search and rescue and all those good things. And I got really interested in sort of the physical adventure, and I went looking for different forms of just to push boundaries, I think, and to test myself. And I ended up in the Marine Corps. So I went to officer candidate school with the Marines, and I actually loved it. I really liked the Marines. But the problem there, of course, is your job is to kill people. And so that was a little disconcerting, and mostly because, you know, what Jung would call the shadow side of one's life, right? That really to embrace that and understand that I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the adventure, the thrill, the challenge. And I was really good at it, I guess I would say. I enjoyed the soldiering part of it, and a little bit too much, which is...
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, this, for the same reason that people like to go hunting or play shooter video games, there's a, I don't want to call it a sort of a male ethos, that propensity towards violence, I think, that we have ingrained in the human nature. And so I really explored that and realized that that wasn't really the life for me, that there was no military conflict, there were no wars going on, so... I didn't really feel like my service was at that point was needed, but I was looking for selfless service. That's really, I think, what I was exploring in the military, and it was some wonderful people there. But that's when I started kind of having a spiritual awakening of sorts, and I met this wonderful sort of holy man who I would call very like Father Zosima, if you remember the Brothers Karamazov and Dostoevsky's great work.
I'm just reading that right now.
Oh, are you really?
Yeah, for the first time.
Really? Oh, wow. So have you gotten to, you know, Father Zosima a little bit?
Yeah, yeah.
So he represents sort of the best of the Catholic ethos, I would say. And there's lots of course, baggage that goes with those belief systems. And but it was very captivating. I felt like if I was ever going to find the meaning of life, which is really, I think, was the ultimate question that was gnawing at me, is why am I here? What's the purpose? And how do I find meaning? And how do I find service to others. And this Zosima character became a very good friend and a father figure to me, and he invited me to join their community. And I originally thought it was going to be like a gap year after college. I was going to take a few years off, try this really different life path and journey, the road less traveled. And it ended up being a 20-year adventure, which I deeply enjoyed and appreciated.
You were in a monastery for 20 years?
Correct. Yeah. So I did the whole bit, wore the robes, and was called Brother Doug. And it was a good adventure.
And that was all here in Santa Fe?
Correct. And that kind of then ties into the story about how I became a money manager, if you want to go into that.
Well, I think one of the things that's so interesting about your story is that you were one of the younger brothers mm-hmm. in this monastery, which is a very small monastery, and you ended up kind of like, well, you weren't old enough to do spiritual counseling of people, so you did the books. And it turned out that the books were a gigantic mess, and that the basically monastery was being run by the personal credit cards of the monks.
Yes, which is quite bizarre, admittedly.
Indeed.
And like you said, I was the youngest monk by 30 years, and so I just sort of trusted we were all living communally and pooling our resources, and I just sort of threw it into the communal pot and let it ride, and things were going very well for the first few years, and then calls started coming in from creditors, and we started running out of money, and we didn't have enough to pay the bills, and so debt started to pile up, and I didn't really know what was going on. I didn't understand why we were in such bad financial shape, and eventually sort of the house of cards came crashing down, and I had to jump in and figure it out. And I think the problem was that we all believe that money is the root of all evil, right? So we took the vow of poverty very seriously, and perhaps a little bit too seriously. And so we sort of abdicated our individual responsibilities to be in charge of our lives and take control of our finances. And so when I dug into the books and tried to clean up the mess, after many months of trying to sort the books out, there was really only one option left, and that was bankruptcy. And so the monastery went bankrupt, and it was a personal bankruptcy for every brother in the community.
Including you?
Including me. Yeah, absolutely. And I realized that was not going to be a healthy way to live our lives. And so to backtrack just a little bit, I think I mentioned that earlier about how my family had a lot of money, and so I was running away from that world. And then, of course, in the monastery, then, of course, everything fell apart. And so I really had to learn firsthand the painful lessons that if you ignore your money for any reason, it's going to come back and bite you in the butt. And that's when I began to develop my skill set. And of course, then we would have guests and we would have visitors come hang out with us. And I wasn't really, I didn't feel wise enough to be giving spiritual advice at the time because I was still in my 20s. I left that to the older monks. But as you hear people's stories about the spiritual struggles they're going through, what struck me was that there was often a financial component to their difficulties. Either was the finance could be a cause of their struggles, or it was a secondary issue, but I had some skills to help. And so I started jumping in, and I did pro bono financial work for about a decade to whoever came up in the monastery. And we handled bankruptcies again. I handled a lot of debt. A lot of people out there are struggling with debt. That seems to be a real common theme, as well as probating estates, helping people with child support, whatever kind of fell into my lap. And that's really how I started on the path to becoming a financial advisor.
One thing that you figured out early on was that the retirement plans for teachers mm-hmm. were just horrible at mm-hmm. every level. Mm-hmm. Private schools, public schools, elementary schools, colleges, even the Ivy League. Mm-hmm. Terrible. What's going on?
Well, it comes back to a key term in finance called fiduciary duty. And so a fiduciary is someone who is legally required to always act in their client's best interest or their employee's best interest. So if you're at a college or university or any school, there's always a fiduciary who has that legal responsibility. But the schools have forgotten that they're the default fiduciary, and they've outsourced their retirement plans to various companies to run, and they forgot that the schools are the ones responsible for monitoring these plans and making sure that they're well run. And so essentially what's happened is the financial services industry is taken over all these plans and they're running them without supervision, without any fiduciary oversight. And so they become very abusive very quickly. The fees are high, the performance of the funds is bad. the architecture, there's a, you know, design matters. As you know, with any gizmo or gadget like an iPad or an iPod or a computer, how you design something really makes a huge difference in how well it works, how well it functions. Doesn't matter whether it's a car, a computer, or a retirement plan. And so a lot of these plans were built back in the 80s. And basically, their architecture is outdated and ineffective. It's kind of like using a rotary phone in a digital age. And so they're very ineffective. And so a lot of folks think that these retirement plans or teachers are getting in trouble because they're not putting enough money in or they're not making enough money. And that's actually not the case. Teachers are putting plenty of money generally into the plans, but the architecture, the structure, the oversight, everything is just messed up and wrong. And I discovered that the hard way as a teacher. And it was actually when I began teaching personal finance and economics as a high school teacher. And it was really a class project with my students was one of the ways I discovered this. There were some other sort of heartbreaking stories, mostly by seeing the horrible pain and suffering that my colleagues were going through who were facing retirement. They would come to me and ask for help, and I'd look at what they had managed to save, and it was a pittance. And it was really because the architecture of the plan was bad, and the funds were bad, and the fees were high, and all those things sort of chip away. And so what happened is I started looking for a company that could do a better job of running these plans, and I couldn't find one. I couldn't find a company that I liked that would take on that fiduciary responsibility for the schools and for the teachers and really and be legally bound to act in the best interest of these employees. And so I started my own company to do that, and it's been very successful.
And so you manage four educational institutions?
Correct. So, well, we have two sort of businesses. One is individual wealth management for high net worth clients. And then we also, my main focus, of course, is then with teacher retirement plans across the country and trying to help make, how to fix this problem. And what was really exciting is that right when I was starting my company, the New York Times did a 7-piece series of articles, just sort of this expose on the very problems that I was seeing. And I realized I had a huge business opportunity there and took advantage of it. And then I got written up in the New York Times, and that was kind of began the whole wonderful journey that I am on now.
You, as you said, came from a wealthy family, and you really had a knack for money management. Do you think that came from your family?
That's a good question. I don't know. I didn't really pick up any skills from my family because I sort of ignored them. I thought, you know, money was evil, and I thought that there, you know, I saw a lot of greed, and I saw a lot of self-centered behavior. And so I don't know if it comes, I don't know if there's some karmic thing there, but my father was a CEO and my mom was a certified financial planner. So they were, obviously I was swimming in that world, but I wasn't really paying attention to it. So maybe I picked some stuff up vicariously. But it's sort of ironic that all these years later, I'm doing the same kind of work that my mom did all those years ago.
Interesting. Now, as you said, there's a kind of divide between those who believe that money is evil or love of money is the root of all evil, however you want to say it, and those who kind of love money too much. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to walk this middle path. Mm-hmm. Tell us about these two sides, their mutual suspicion, and then how you're kind of navigating that.
Yeah, so I think I found that the excessive love of money, or that sort of what we think of greed or avarice, that can often grip people, and that obsessive focus on it can be extremely destructive. But ignoring it and extreme poverty, the suffering that that produces is just as detrimental and damaging to people's lives. So it's kind of that middle way. It's like, how do you find a healthy balance between excessive greed on one hand and also living your fullest life, living your values, right? Being able to provide for yourself, for your family, for your children. We all need money. We can't survive in the world without it. Even monks, right? So everyone's got to eat.
As I
found out. Everyone's got to have health insurance. Everyone has got car payments. Everyone's going to need new tires someday. And so money management is something that everyone has to master. No one gets to opt out of that. And so really, from monk to money manager, my book is trying to explore that and kind of try to give people a really healthy way to live their values and to see how money is that really essential tool for doing that. And to avoid suffering, because the suffering that poverty produces is quite horrific. It's just devastating. And a lot, some of it is socioeconomic and culture, and some of it's just bad planning. And like what we experience, there's no reason why we should have gone bankrupt other than our own for lack of a better word, negligence, or our own lack of mindfulness, maybe is a better word to use. We weren't being mindful of our money. We weren't being in how we were using it and spending it. And that leads to tremendous heartache.
Well, as you say, I mean, there was another book I read years ago that talked about what they called the pathogens of poverty. Mm-hmm. And those pathogens of poverty, I mean, everything from physical diseases, mental and emotional and behavioral stuff, social problems like addiction and domestic mm-hmm. violence, premature death, so many different kinds of unhappiness.
Yeah.
And your idea is that everybody should be a little bit wealthy, quote
yeah.
unquote.
Yes.
What does that mean, a little bit wealthy?
Well, it means being able to have health care. It means being able to send your kids to college. It means being able to retire with dignity and not be panicked and stressed out about it. You know, and as you pointed out, we now know there was a great study from the Journal of Consumer Research that found that the quality of your financial life has as much impact on your overall mental health as your job satisfaction, your physical health, and your relationship stability combined, right? So this money is the driver for so much of our suffering, those pathogens you talk about. And so really, how do you mitigate those pathogens? How do you understand that, you know, socioeconomic status is the number one predictor we have for death, disease, and mortality by far? So whether it's obesity, addiction, all these sort of social ills, you go through the list, every single one of them can be reduced or eliminated just by increasing someone's net worth.
At the same time, you think that anti-poverty programs don't work.
Well, I think they're very difficult. I think my book is an attempt at a kind of anti-poverty program, but the question is how effective is government intervention, right? What role does government play in our lives? And that's a deep and a difficult debate, which I just touch on briefly. But we know when you look at, say, the Russians, the experiments of communism, or the Chinese experiment with communism and in the Great Leap Forward, that it has produced some of the most horrific genocides. Whenever we try to sort of create a deeply communistic or socialistic experiments, when they've been tried, they've all failed horrifically, even though their intentions may be good and they start off high-minded. But the historical evidence is clear that that's really a very dangerous and difficult path. So I'm not opposed to some government poverty reduction programs. I think Social Security, for example, is a great anti-poverty tool, and you know, thank God we have it. But at some point, people do have the freedom to make their own decisions, and they have in that freedom the opportunity to make bad decisions. And in those bad decisions, that's what we're trying to sort of help people mitigate and avoid some of the pitfalls that come from having an unhealthy attitude towards money in their lives. So, you know, the question about anti-poverty programs is really how much control do you want government to have? And whether it's on the liberal side or the conservative side, when government takes over people's lives to the point where it tries to eliminate poverty completely, the only way to do that is to eliminate free will. And the only way to eliminate free will from bad decisions is with a gun and violence. And that becomes you sort of have bad choices and worse choices, right? So it's not that I'm opposed to anti-poverty programs. It's just that when they become really extreme and intrusive into people's lives, there's an unintended consequences. The solution is often worse than the cure. The cure is worse than the disease, is that was what I meant to say.
I mean, it's one thing, and kind of a straw man, to bash Stalinism.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, you know, the New Deal
mm-hmm.
and the Affordable Care Act,
sure.
which
mm-hmm.
all but eliminates medical bankruptcy
mm-hmm.
and the entirety of Scandinavia.
Yes.
Those are all anti-poverty. Those are all government anti-poverty programs.
Absolutely. So that's why I don't want to make a blanket statement and say that anti-poverty programs are bad or wrong. But they have a limited ability to be effective, particularly, I think, in our modern political, and I would say in America, especially in our current political environment.
Well, and that's the thing. There's a kind of tension and ongoing, seemingly irreconcilable argument between those who believe in anti-poverty programs and more equitable mm-hmm. policy on the one hand,
right.
and then personal responsibility on the other hand. And I've never seen why those have to be opposed to each other at all. I mean, it seems like both are absolutely necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have to take responsibility, but you also have to take responsibility for a society that has, especially ours, that has so much extreme inequity and unfairness built into mm-hmm. its very structures.
Yep. Yep, I agree. I don't think there's a lot of daylight between us on that point. But at some level, right, if you're going to make bad decisions, there's going to be consequences to that. And maybe what I try to do is sort of avoid politics a little bit in the sense that I have no control over the political system beyond my vote and my voice, as we all do. And it's important that we make our voices heard. But it's really an attempt to say, how are you going to pragmatically deal with the reality of the world as it is right now in America in 2019? How are you going to make your life better without waiting for these wonderful utopian ideals to come into fruition or waiting for the right political environment or waiting for the right policies?
Or working for the right policies.
And so I'm all in favor of all of those things. I'm not in any way opposed to them, but they're a little abstract and they're also not certain to ever happen in my lifetime. So I have to sort of deal with the pragmatic reality of what it means right now, where I'm at, how am I going to make the best of a sometimes bad situation.
One of the things that you write about a little bit is the question of how our society's Judeo-Christian heritage has influenced our cultural ideas about money.
Yeah.
Can you say more about that?
So I think one of the things I found that was really curious and exciting for me as I went from being completely ignorant about finance and completely ignorant about how economics works was that my understanding of economics, and I think much of our religious admonitions against money and wealth, come from really this old world understanding of how economies and societies work. So it's important to remember that in the time of the Bible, whether it's Old Testament, New Testament, corporations didn't even exist back then, right? Democracy, rule of law, these things were non-existent as we currently understand them.
They barely existed when our Constitution was written.
Exactly right. So the middle class wasn't invented for about, I think, don't hold me to it, it's like 1,400 years after the New Testament was written. And so in the time of Jesus, wealth was really a zero-sum game. So a zero-sum game is like sports. For one team to gain a point, one team has to lose a point, right? So it's zero sum, plus one minus one equals zero. And most of our religious texts are grounded in an economic system that was zero sum. So if you were a wealthy person in the time of Jesus, it by necessity almost required you to be a greedy, selfish, power-hungry scoundrel. There was really no other option. It was more like Spartacus than Pleasantville. And so in that kind of system where wealth is dependent upon oppressing and enslaving others, I just saw a statistic today, I think 8 out of 10 people were living in slavery in the time of Jesus, of some sort, whether it's economic or serfdom of some kind. And so slavery was pretty much the norm, and this horrible political and social oppression just surrounded people. So it was a zero-sum game. So if I'm wealthy, that means I really did something probably horrible to another human being. And so, of course, we're going to, if you're asking a religious and spiritual leader like the apostles or Jesus or Buddha or any of the great saints, you know, whose side do you expect them to be on except the downtrodden, the oppressed? Of course. But what, in a modern economy, now, obviously, you can be an oppressor, and obviously you can do horrible things with your wealth, and you can get it in very evil and unscrupulous ways. But no one has to lose in order for me to earn money, save it, and ethically invest it. Right? So my wealth in a modern economy does not have to come at the expense of anyone else. My wealth exists despite their poverty. And so in that system, I think we need a different set of rules, a different way of looking at it, so that we can avoid that greedy, narcissistic, selfish individualism that can really be destructive. We want to eliminate that, but we also want to find a way that people can live with dignity and have good lives and live their values, care for their families, care for their children. And those things are going to require wealth, and you're going to need to be able to have a healthy relationship to it and master your own emotional issues around it. And so we want to use these tools in a healthy, helpful way. It gets into much more deeper in the back of the book about ethical and socially environmentally responsible investing. How can we use money as a tool to make the change we want to see happen, particularly around the environment? I think that's a huge issue. And if we can move all of our investments into environmentally and socially responsible investments, which are now outperforming conventional investing, right? So it's actually not just the right thing to do. It's a smarter way to invest. And so how do we use all the economic tricks we have in our toolkit to build the world that we want to see in the future and not let it control us and not be manipulated and abused by it?
I think this question of what is and isn't a zero-sum game is an important one, because there's a lot of factors that go into, I mean, there's a lot of things that I question when you say that. For example, you know, you write something like the poor are poor despite other people's wealth, not because of it, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, I found that a little hard to swallow given the discrepancy between CEO pay mm-hmm. and the workers' pay and struggling workers both in this country and other countries. And, I mean, I once did a sort of back-of-the-napkin calculation of what if the CEO of McDonald's mm-hmm. got rid of two-thirds of his salary and gave it to the workers, mm-hmm. they would be fine.
Yes. And I agree with you. So I was going to interrupt you and say a little caveat on that. I think what I said in the book is my wealth does not come at the expense of anyone else, right? How I live my life and try to live my values, there's nothing in what I do that I can point. I'm sure there's some, you know, somewhere there's something in my portfolio or in something I've bought or done that may have some unintended consequence that's negative. It's almost impossible to eliminate that entirely. But maybe the science analogy is a better metaphor. So is physics good or bad? Let's just kind of put it in a, and that's kind of a black and white question. And of course, nothing that's sort of dualistic thinking, but let's play with it for a minute and say, on the whole, on the sum, do we like physics or do we not like physics? And I think the answer, if we have to be honest, we'd say physics is a good thing. Electricity and magnetism is a good thing. Inertia, momentum, all these rules of Newton and Einstein are great. But they can also be used to build an AR-15 that someone can walk into a school and start blowing kids away with. So is it the physics that's the problem, or how we're using the physics, or people, how we're using these tools? And I think that analogy applies to economics and money as well. So there's no doubt that you're correct in saying that we have a huge income disparity in America. We have some huge social injustices and systemic problems that we as a culture and society have to address, especially around the environment in particular. But that doesn't mean that economics in itself or that wealth creation is in itself evil, right? And is inherently evil. So that's the question, is money, wealth accumulation, and economics on a macro level, on the highest levels of analysis, right? Is it good or is it bad? And I think if we look at it on the high level and we understand how economics really works, on the whole, it's been a tremendous force for good in the world. We've pulled, I think, over 1 billion people out of poverty in just the past 20 years alone by building better economic infrastructures around the globe. It's a huge achievement. It's a huge suffering reduction tool. Think of all the vaccines we've invented. Think of all the medicine that we have. Think of all the infrastructure in our society. On the whole, it's produced a tremendous amount of good in the world. So how do we maximize the good and minimize the evil outcomes? And to focus just on the evil and just to say, well, look at all the horrible things, look at the politicians and the various people who are using the economic tools for their own selfish gain, very real. But there's another side of that coin, which is, on the whole, is my life now better than the average person lived even just 100, 200 years ago? I mean, think about it. I think it was just 100 years ago, the average life expectancy in America I'm going to go back a little farther than that, but maybe 150 years ago, the average life expectancy was only around 45. I'd be dead by now. And for example, when I was born, I was a preemie, right? And so the incubator had just been invented. I'd be dead without modern technology, without modern economics. All these things, on the whole, have added tremendous value and good to the world and good to our lives. The fact that we're having this conversation in your beautiful studio, well, this is in part the product of our economic system, and it's a very good thing to have. And can we celebrate it? Can we enjoy it? Can we celebrate that you have this wonderful show and you're reaching a wonderful audience and being able to get your message out and educate people? These are great things. These are great tools.
It's true, but it's not available to everybody. It's not available to most people on the earth, and it's not sustainable. All the beautiful things that you're talking about are built on a system of, first of all, I mean, there's many downsides like antibiotics and antibiotic resistance. Antibiotics are a beautiful thing. I wouldn't be alive without antibiotics. And one of the biggest downsides, of course, is climate change.
Yes.
And, I mean, Naomi Klein has written eloquently about how it really is capitalism versus the climate. You're holding out something different. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the reality of especially climate change and the people in power holding capitalism really as it is for as
yes.
long as they possibly can. I mean, that's, you know, with no other interest besides their own quarterly profits.
Right. And I'm going to argue that that's not real capitalism in part. That part.
But that's what we've got.
Yes. But that's what I'm trying to change.
I mean, you're talking about the reality as we
but
are
that's,
living
that's
in.
The one thing I think we have to change. And I'm struggling very aggressively. I'm doing everything I can to be a thought leader in the industry. And, you know, I've gotten written up in a lot of the trade journals for the work we've been doing at Longview Asset Management to, you know, we don't take clients right now unless they believe as passionately as we do in protecting the environment and aligning their investments with their values. And if we can shift people's thinking about economics and to show them that investing for the future while destroying the future makes no sense, right? And we now know that investing environmentally and in socially responsible ways is more profitable. It's actually better business sense because we have a lot of data came out of Harvard University, came out of Oxford University, Deutsche Bank, even Bank of America and Merrill Lynch have done all the research on this stuff and have found that companies that are environmentally and socially responsible, not only do they get better profits, they actually outperform because they're not just thinking about this quarter's report. They're thinking about how they're going to be sustainable over the decades. And when you're an investor, you want to look for the long term, right? You're investing for retirement. Obviously, you want a portfolio that's going to sustain you over your entire life. Over, you know, it's going to have to be a 40, 50-year window horizon you're thinking about. And so what happens this quarter is absolutely irrelevant to your retirement portfolio and why I encourage people to ignore the day-to-day fluctuations of the market and look at the long term. And the companies that perform the best over the long term are the ones who are looking at the long term and how are they going to be sustainable within their communities, within the context of environment and social justice. And they're doing it and doing it very brilliantly and doing it well. And so the people that you were referring to earlier who are just worried about the status quo, in part, they're not letting the free market be free. They're trying to hold it back. They're trying to protect the oil industry. They're trying to protect the energy industry. Whereas if we really allow the free market to do its thing and we can shift people's consciousness about their investments, I think we have hope. I think there's an opportunity here, particularly on the institutional side, going back to the beginning of our conversation with teacher retirement plans. One of the things that got me so passionate about it is we're the first firm that we know of building the first environmentally responsible institutional retirement plan. So if you're an employee at one of the schools that we work with, you will be automatically defaulted into environmentally and socially responsible investments. The whole plan is designed that way from the beginning, from the ground up, rather than being some niche option that you can choose if you happen to have a conscience. And we're doing that and getting great performance. And that's really revolutionary. There's approximately around $25 trillion in institutional retirement plan investments across our country. And if we can shift that money into environmentally and socially responsible investments, we can move the market. We can move the entire economy in that direction, make higher profits, live the lives we want to live, live our values, and sustain our planet and our communities. And that's really, I think, the long-term goal.
Very interesting. One of the problems that I see is that people who go into kind of the highest levels of the finance world, whether it be very big companies, banks, investment firms, and so on, Wall Street, they enter a culture that's not healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And they are about making the most amount of money possible. They have their own worlds, their own neighborhoods, their own clubs.
Mm-hmm.
They gradually kind of forget that everybody else in the world is just like them.
Right. And I think that was that goes to the heart of the book. I think that's really the problem I was trying to address in my own head. It was a problem for me internally because I think the greatest insight of world religions, of all spirituality, is that idea that we're all interconnected. Right? And in my tradition, I would say, within my community of faith, we would say that God is everywhere, in everyone, and in everything. So that's something that I think you can justify theologically. And I also think it's something I not only believe it, but have experienced on a very deep personal level. I see God everywhere and everyone. And so that's a simple reality, a spiritual reality that I think all great leaders within the religious traditions of our world would agree with. So with that truth and with that understanding, now how do we take that reality and map it onto what we know about the science of economics, right? Because economics tells us the exact same thing. We're all interconnected intimately. For example, you know, my spending is someone else's income, right? And someone else's spending is my income. So we're all literally, absolutely interconnected. There's no way around that fact. So how are we going to use the science of economics to make us more aware of it and use it for the greatest good possible? That's the challenge I think we're going to be facing over the next, well, we're facing it right now. Like it's the most urgent issue I think of our time is how are we going to use this tool of economics to shift the global consciousness, if you will, and shift our world so that our spiritual values and insights are aligned with our economic practices and policies.
Well, and I see, you know, you and your company doing that, and ethical investing is definitely a growing sector, and that's fantastic and environmentally responsible and so on. But you still have this culture of a very exclusive and exclusionary culture mm-hmm. of extreme wealth, which is male-dominated, mm-hmm. alpha males, sociopaths, and just culturally connected people
yep.
who really, truly... And they're trained this way because mm-hmm. I know people, I mean, I went to school with some of these people mm-hmm. who were lovely and then they turned into these monsters.
Yep. Yep. Amen to that. Absolutely correct. And so how are we going to shift that?
And they're nice people when individually, but they are part of this monstrous.
Yep. And I was at a birthday party for a friend this weekend. And when one of the guests was telling me about how he's a lobbyist for the oil and gas industry and all the things he was doing. And it was like, and yet here he is. Supposedly, you know, with some progressive values, and he knows the right words, and you can see the guilt in his face a little bit, but yet he knows this is not the right way to be living his life, and he's doing it anyway. And it's kind of like, well, that's, I think, the definition of unethical behavior, and we need to call it out as such and call it what it is. And I think you're absolutely correct.
The calling has been going on for centuries.
Yes, but it's been, here's the thing, is the calling people out is that you can't call people, you have no credibility and you have no power to affect change from the outside. So if you're outside the financial system, if you hate everything that capitalism stands for, if you hate everything that economics stands for, and you're just sort of screaming into the wind, it's not going to get you very far. And so there's this practical insight, I think, that contemplation and action is the key, right? You want to have this deep contemplative practice and you want to put it into action. But if you're going to be effective in the financial industry, you have to be an insider. You have to see it objectively, honestly, see its strengths, praise the strengths. Here's all the great things that money, economics, capitalism can do for us. And here's the danger.
Like the sixth great extinction.
Yeah, so we have the capacity to destroy civilization as we know it. And that's absolutely real.
And the natural world.
Yes. And so there is an existential threat that we face as a civilization through the problem of climate change. So how are we going to, I guess that's my question. And what I'm trying to explore is how are we going to solve it? If all we do is say capitalism is evil and money is evil, you're not seeing the truth. Money is not the root of all evil. Money is the root of everything, good and evil. You can't operate in a modern world without money, right? Nothing happens. I couldn't have driven here to get to this interview without gas in my car or even a car or car insurance. So we know money is going to be, it's here to stay. So how are we going to use it for the greater good? And how are we going to use it to solve these deep, deep existential problems?
Do you have any evidence or sort of any hopeful signs that this way of thinking that you're doing is having an effect on sort of the major institutions that at this point are the culprit of really the worst effects of, I mean, the two big ones, environmental destruction and inequality.
Yeah. So environmentally, we'll call it sustainable investing, right, is the new, it's the new in thing in finance. Over a quarter of all the new money coming into the market is socially and environmentally responsible investing. So all the major institutions are getting behind it. And if we can get everyone on board with that, we pretty much, I want to say the problem is solved, but...
It's a big if.
It's a big if, but it's not that big of an if you understand what I was saying earlier, that it can produce higher profits. It's kind of a Trojan horse, if you will, in a way that if you really understand what the core message behind it is it's using greed and capitalism, I don't want to say against itself, but it's really making this very clear, researched, mathematical argument about why protecting the environment isn't just a moral issue and an economic issue, it's a profit issue. That you can get higher profits by being environmentally and socially responsible.
Do you think that kind of thinking will do away with the fossil fuel industry?
Yes and no. So even at our firm, at Longview Asset Management, we still have money in energy companies, but we do what's called best-in-class investing. So we don't want to destroy the energy industry as it is. We want to transform it. So we want to move it into renewable energy, which is where the future needs to go. So we're not going to, in time we will destroy it. In time, it's not going to happen right away, but I think it's possible that, and this is something that, not my idea, others have said it, that really we're on this cusp with renewable energy that some people are comparing to the analogy of cell phones, right? So when cell phones first came out, very few people had them. It's called the network effect, or like Facebook, right? When you first start something, right? Very few people have it, but as more and more people go in that direction, it becomes more and more valuable. There was this rapid adoption of, say, cell phone technology, this rapid adoption of, say, social media. We went from an era where it was non-existent, say, the 90s, and here we are in 2019, and look how ubiquitous and omnipresent these things are. And that we're really on the cusp of that same radical transformation with renewable energy, that we can have a massive scale-up effect, that the growth of this industry is not linear. It's not going to be this slow sort of build-up, but it could be exponential, right? So we could hit this exponential growth of renewable energy, and we can very quickly scale up these technologies to, in time, replace the fossil fuel industry and hopefully get rid of it entirely. And that's the real hope, and that's the real challenge to move in that direction.
You, Doug, are painting a rosy picture of capitalism or the potential of capitalism. And again, you know, the world divides into capitalist and anti-capitalist, and I really see both sides of that. Mm-hmm. But there are some real problems that I see and that I experience, which is that capitalism is all about, in so many ways, at least as it is now, providing stuff that we don't need, mm-hmm. and trying to monetize every single part of my body, minute of my day,
yes.
and everything else. And there's something really oppressive and unnatural about that, especially because it keeps accelerating.
Yes. And I think that is, so everything has a shadow side, everything has a dark side. And so I think that's a really excellent point, that one of the great dangers of capitalism is the ability to manufacture desires, right? And so we now, of course, this is the great insight of Buddhist teaching, of course, as well as any of the great religious traditions, is the understanding that if you exponentially grow your desire, you're exponentially growing your suffering and unhappiness, right? And so at some point, you need to figure out what's enough. Right? And I don't think we've reached that point as a individually or collectively come up with very good answers about what's enough. When do we need to sort of scale back our grasping and our desire for more and more and more? Because if we allow capitalism to feed on that cycle indefinitely without some moral check, and this is why I think it's so important for spirituality and religion and economics and finance to come back together. I think they've gone their separate ways. How are we going to bring the economic tools and align them with our deepest values so that we aren't allowing the worst sides of capitalism to run rampant over our worlds, our communities, our cultures, and create, it can be extraordinarily destructive when all we're trying to do is monetize every little thing and just having you constantly dissatisfied. I mean, that's the job of advertising. Every ad of any sort has the same root message, which is you suck unless you buy what we're selling. Right? So they have to constantly market and sell dissatisfaction, and then actually even create a dissatisfaction or a longing or a desire in you and me that then they can fulfill through the product or service that they're selling. That's the very nature of advertising. And when we start advertising everywhere on everything and everything becomes commoditized, you know, then we're in a space where we're letting the tool run our lives.
And all of that is fine, and that makes sense to me. And as far as I'm concerned, I mean, I strive for a life where I spend more time outdoors and with people and doing things that really can't or shouldn't be monetized, mm-hmm. that are just natural things that are human things to do, mm-hmm. like spending time with one another. But when we talk about capitalism, we're talking about continual growth, as much growth as possible, as quickly as possible. And we're living on a planet with finite resources. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we can use every last tree in the forest and take every, I mean, it's the whole extractive idea, take every last fish out of the sea. Mm-hmm. Those things are not kept in check by capitalism. Mm-hmm. So we've got a problem. I mean, on the one hand, you want to, for moral and ethical and human reasons, not be a slave to the market and these desires that are being created by it. On the other hand, you want to have growth.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that's the tension, and that's the paradox that I don't know that there's no simple answer to the problem, but at least we can formulate the question and try to come to some individual conclusions for ourselves individually, and hopefully we can change our society at the same time.
Every creature evolved from another creature. Every movement in art history evolved from the previous movement, every literary movement, and every economic system evolved from the one before it. Mm-hmm. Do you see a kind of post-capitalist evolution that takes the best of what we have and gets rid of some of the worst?
Yes, although I don't know quite what it is yet. I'm not sure we're figuring that out. We're in this era of radical transformation, upheaval. I think that's the beauty and the opportunity in this very chaotic time, is everything seems to be reordering itself in some spiritual way that I'm hopeful about. Even in the midst of all of our political turmoil and all the chaos that we see, there's something fundamentally reordering itself in the very structure of our civilization and our economy. And I don't know what the final product is going to look like. And I don't think it ever ends, right? So that's the great thing about evolution. It's not a destination, it's a process.
Right. Right?
And so will that process of economic evolution ever end? It better not, because as soon as we stop evolving and we stop trying to come up with new and creative ways of ordering our civilization, then I think we're going to be stuck in a downward spiral. And as you pointed out, with an extractive economy, it's extraordinarily devastating and dangerous. Either we will either change and evolve or grow, or we'll die.
The book is called From Monk to Money Manager. You started as a monk, now you're a money manager. So you've got this very long basis of spiritual contemplation and practice. Does your work awaken in you any of those kinds of impulses of greed or excessive love of money? Is that something that you have to kind of like deal with, keep in check?
No, really not. I think I kind of dealt with those issues a long time ago. I certainly enjoy the comforts and the security that money brings, the ability to live my life the way that I feel is most appropriate for me. Money gives you freedom, and it also gives you power, and it can give you the power to do a lot of good in the world. You know, when I work with clients, the suffering I see in my clients is just staggering. Let's say I'm working with a college. I will be managing the accounts of the president of the college and the janitorial maintenance staff and kitchen staff. So I'm talking to all these people across all socioeconomic boundaries and ethnic boundaries. And what's really fascinating, this is a really, just blew me away when I saw it, was that sometimes you would expect that the amount of retirement savings that someone has is proportional to their income, right? So that the president of a college would have the most retirement savings of anyone in the school. Not true. So I have one school that's a client down in Albuquerque, and I was sitting down with one of their cafeteria workers who makes about $30,000 a year, and She had a solid six. She was in her third. She's about 35. She had immigrated to America as a young girl. She's married, has two kids. Her husband works construction, and she's a diligent saver because she grew up in rural poverty in Mexico, and decided she didn't want that life for herself or for her children. And on the very meager salary, she already has six-figure savings at the age of 35, and is on track to have well over $1 million by the time she retires. And it's like, well, I'm not saying what she did was easy, but it's very, very possible. And so all through the hierarchy of an institution, whether it's the janitorial staff or the teachers, I see a number of teachers who, because they're mindful of their money, because they're not going into debt, and because they're saving regularly, and they let the market work on their behalf, and what we call compound interest, which is how money grows exponentially. They're really capturing the long-term returns of the market. They're actually very wealthy. It can be done. That's the fun thing about seeing how money habits have a profound impact over time. And if you can get your money habits right, and you can do a couple of simple key things right off the bat, like trying to save 10 to 15% of your income into retirement when you start working, try to increase your savings just a little bit every month, or every year, excuse me. If you can shoot for a 1% increase in your savings rate every year, and you do that for 30, 40 years, and you're mindful about how that's being invested with good asset allocation, stocks, bonds, those sorts of things, you can retire with a lot of wealth and really be doing well for yourself. So that's really exciting news that I think people need to hear.
Doug Lynam is author of the book From Monk to Money Manager. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It was an honor.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanham Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.